Welcome to Better Cybersecurity, the ISF podcast. I'm your host, Steve Durbin.
ISF Chief Executive Steve Durbin is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In this episode, Steve speaks with Alex Bovee, co-founder and CEO of C1, a technology company focused on identity security online. Steve and Alex discuss why identity still often is an afterthought when businesses look at their risk profiles, and how governance is changing as employees get access to more and more systems. Alex also shares his thoughts on how to translate identity management to board members and how to adapt technology so that it fits your team, not the other way around.
So in a global economy defined by volatility, the most valuable asset any company possesses is its trust. But trust is no longer just a handshake. It's a digital signature, set of permissions, and an ongoing verification process. Now, today I'm joined by Alex Bovee. Alex is the CEO of Conductor One. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Yeah, Steve, appreciate it.
Now, Alex, you're in the business of securing the modern workforce, but let's look past the tech for a moment. In your view, why has identity become such a blind spot?
I think one of the challenges with identity has always been that it's a huge security surface area, but it just used to be that maybe 10, 15 years ago, a lot of that was obfuscated by the fact that access control, governance, management was constrained behind the firewall. I think it's just an old architectural conundrum. And then what we saw during the cloud era and SaaS adoption was that identity moved outside of the firewall. It adopted SaaS applications. Modern tech-forward businesses just eliminated their on-prem footprint altogether. And so that sprawl was always there, but it really made it obvious because now the sprawl was in daylight. And that's where some of the terms like identity is the new perimeter came from, because identity moved outside of the firewall. Like, you have to protect identity. It necessarily is a perimeter, just like a network perimeter or, you know, your data infrastructure and security. So I think it was always more or less a challenge. It's just that we had layers of protection around identity previously. And then with a lot of these technological shifts, the security issues have been bigger, broader, more obvious now. And now with AI happening and agentic identity, it's really sprawled even further. And non-human identity, it's sprawled even further. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges is we've moved outside of the firewall. That's been happening for a long time. But then the types of identities have really just exploded and the sprawl hasn't really been contained.
Yeah, it's moving outside the perimeter. Many are now calling actually an identity-first world. I'm curious, in your experience, is the C-suite finally seeing identity as something of a strategic risk, or are we still treating it as something more of a secondary IT function, do you think?
I am definitely seeing it more as a strategic risk. And maybe that's a little bit of a selection bias because our customers tend to care a lot about identity and
right.
Buy our
product. Of course.
But I would say that most forward-thinking CISOs 100% view identity as one of the most important pillars in their company that they need to protect and secure, right up there around, like I said, data, network, and things like that, in AppSec and endpoints. So I believe that that transition has already been happening. I think that most forward-thinking CISOs are already looking at identity as one of the most important assets they have as a business that needs to be protected, in part because those assets are the way that access is governed and controlled. And if you get access to someone's credential, you effectively can assume their identity, which gives you access to the data and the systems that they have. And that's just more and more the way that we see breaches happening. So I think the business realities and the cybersecurity realities have really necessitated that you just can't see it as an afterthought anymore. And if you do see it as an afterthought, it's probably just a matter of time before you have a major security incident or some major problem in your business.
Yeah. You touched on earlier the SaaS environment, cloud apps and so on. I'm curious, how do you govern access when the average enterprise employee is now interacting with dozens, maybe more, different mini ecosystems every day? Is, for instance, least privilege actually achievable, or is that something of a myth?
Yeah, those are great questions. I think one of the challenges with not just SaaS adoption at this point, but now with AI adoption, is that there's a sprawl of identities, there's a sprawl of access, there's a sprawl of applications and systems that people have access to. And We saw this back in 2010 where companies that tried to prevent SaaS adoption, for example, ended up with SaaS adoption, just shadow SaaS adoption.
Yeah.
And I think the most forward-leaning companies are realizing, particularly in this AI era, that the best way to secure what's going to happen with AI is to give people a safe, easy path that they can use that is by default safe, by default governed. I think that's the opportunity to your question about how do you secure that is you put guardrails in place, you have a strong governance program, you give people the tools they want in the categories that they want, and you make it easy for them to adopt them. And if you do that, generally speaking, people won't stray off of the happy path because they get what they need from the happy path. I think part of it's policy and part of it's technology. On the policy side, it's about CISOs being able to say yes, security being the department of yes, not the department of no. And how do you do that? You have to do it from a position of strength of governance and default security. In terms of the technology that you use, the guardrails you use, the policies and controls that you have in place. And I think if you didn't do that, then you can give your team the tools and you don't have to worry as much about the shadow outside adoption of technology and tools.
And we've touched on sort of AI a couple of times already. With the rise of deepfakes, and I know this is a very real concern for a lot of ISF members and others, of course, with the rise of deepfakes, AI-driven social engineering, the identity, in inverted commas, of a caller, of an email sender, there's no longer a certainty. So how do our underlying access architectures have to evolve to verify trust in a world where, frankly, seeing is just no longer believing, is it?
Yeah, I remember a year ago, there was multiple examples of, I think it was people deepfaking CEOs and board members and trying to get financial transactions made and things like that. So I think that there's different, I would say, classes of deepfake type attacks. There's more of your broad-based social engineering type attacks. And I think one of the impacts of AI on that is that AI is able to do that at scale and in a very targeted way. I think we're going to see a lot of asymmetry happening in those types of attacks. And then the second category is much more of your targeted attack where you're trying to deepfake the CEO, calling the CFO, asking for a immediate wire transfer to pay for something. So I think there's no right answer across the board broadly. But what I would say is that the old practices and patterns that were good 20 years ago and 10 years ago are still good today. It's just they're really necessary. So things like being able to do multi-factor authentication on financial transactions, having multi-step approvals and business processes, those are the types of things that if you don't have those basic controls in place, something not good is probably going to happen. And the reason it's going to happen is because AI lets attackers just scale that out and scale those attacks in a really believable way very quickly and across a broad base of people. So I think you have to look at your internal processes, whether that's help desk password resets or how you're verifying non-employees or how you do customer service or how you verify financial transactions and approve those. So I think every part of the chain is a little bit different, but I think the best practices are still the best practices.
Yeah, lots of process in there and test it. That's the other thing I would add to that. Try it out, try and break it. All the things that the external guys will do. We do talk a lot about external hackers, don't we? The accidental insider remains a massive vulnerability. How can automated identity governance act as a safety net for plain old human error without making the employee feel like they're being constantly policed?
Yeah, I think the best kind of security controls are the ones that are just in place, that work, that are silent, and you don't know they're there, but they let you do your job. Mm-hmm. And then they only really kick in when you need a human verification or an escalation or something that is off the sort of beaten path, if you will. I think this is mostly on the technology side at this point. The opportunity on the technology side is to put tools in place that make it easy for the team to have access, not super disruptive to their workflows. But when they look at doing something sensitive or accessing sensitive data or need something, that's when you get to more of your early question, the least privileged question. By default, you don't have it. You can get it. It's time bound. You get access to the things, but by default, the kind of security posture of the organization ideally constantly comes back to a lower equilibrium than a standing type world. So I think there are concepts like least privilege that really help with that. But I think this really boils down to technology at the end of the day, and just making sure that technology is not intrusive. Your users aren't going to rebel against it. And if we go back two questions, I think this is exactly the same point here is if your technology is intrusive, if it is a terrible experience, your users will work around it and you're going to end up with a problem anyways.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I think the other thing I'd add to that is, which again, I think we can do a better job of doing within the organization, is just explaining the why behind, not barriers, but some of the restrictions we're putting in place.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. The human element of this and the human training element and education element just can't be understated, because you can have technology and process all day long, but at the end of the day, you also really do depend on people to try to make relatively good decisions and smart decisions and not do dumb security, not run open claws on their laptops and things like that when it comes out. So, you have to be on top of those trends, and you do have to communicate it and say, look, this is something we don't recommend doing. Please don't do this. This is why we're worried about doing that. And I think people generally want to do the right thing. I agree with you on that one.
Yeah. Now, we talk a lot about multi-factor. Most organizations, we would imagine, would have that in place. But in the boardroom, that's not what people want to hear. They want to hear about things like risk mitigation. So how do you translate identity lifecycle management into a language that really resonates with, say, the CFO or the chairman?
Yeah, that's a really great question, actually, because I think too often identity in particular is lumped into the IT category of kind of process and automation and streamlining, join, remove, reliever, and things like that. And I think the missed opportunity there is to tell the two sides of the coin with identity, which is we're getting the productivity benefits and the automation benefits and the access control benefits of tooling and technology and process we're putting in place here. But the ultimate goal of that is that we're reducing risk by making sure that people are offboarded correctly, that we can achieve least privilege, that we can do just-in-time access, that we know the AI tools that people are using in our environment, and we can control data access across them. So I think part of it is speaking in terms of risk. It's really basically what you said, which is translate the technology and process and tools you've put into place in terms of risk mitigation, not just the productivity benefits that you're going to get from the tooling.
Now, you mentioned about security trying to be the department of yes. All too often, it's still seen as the department of no. How can a robust identity strategy, though, actually help or empower a culture of autonomy and trust rather than perhaps stifling it?
Yeah, I think when your identity program by default gives your security team visibility across what's happening, the enablement to adopt AI tools and agents and productivity agents and securely access data, I think that is the department of yes, because that's saying, look, we know that this is a emerging field of AI, but we know that the team wants to be more productive. We know that they want to use these tools, but here's our rules in place. Use our tooling to get access to the data and the MCPs we have in the environment. Request access for additional services that you might want to bring in. Please don't self-serve sign up for external services and generate OAuth tokens to connect them to your Gmail or your Entra tenant. And if that does happen, we're going to get alerted on it and we're going to go chase it down, or we're going to by default block it and deny it. So I think part of it is about, it's okay to say no, so long as the answer is, and here's what you do instead. So I think that's the key, is recognizing where the team wants to go and where the business needs to go, actually, because every single board is pushing CIOs and CISOs to go adopt AI and tooling and tech. Every single board conversation is, what are you doing to make the team more AI native? What are you doing to help adopt AI tools? So the answer just can't be the one-sided, we're shutting it down, we're figuring it out. It's, hey, we've shut this down, but we've given people this other path that they can use to adopt it. So I think it's about having both of those answers. It's okay to say no, so long as you can say yes in a different direction.
Yeah, no, absolutely. One of the things that also causes, and certainly again, a lot of the people that I talk to scratch their heads, is the management of security expectation across different age generations in the workforce. So if you look at, say, a Gen Z workforce versus, a boomer, the younger element would expect almost a consumer-grade experience at work, right? They expect to be able to get exactly the same experience as they do when they're at home or at the weekends and what have you. How do you manage that security expectation across different aged workforces, and particularly with the younger ones that perhaps view the traditional clunky security protocols as a challenge even to work around?
I think it's hard. I think a lot of this does, for better or worse, boil down to the technology that you choose as a business, because if you're choosing technology that is clunky and hard to use and it wasn't well POV'd and the team doesn't really like it and doesn't have a great user experience, I think one of two truths is true. One, people are going to work around it and they're going to complain about it and they're going to not like you. Or two, it might actually just end up being very hard to attract the younger workforce to work for you, because a lot of times the younger workforce, they want to be super productive. They want to use new tools and technologies because they're looking at it as an investment in their career. If they're going to a business and you're fresh out of college as an engineer, you're going to a company and the default stance of the company is that we don't use AI tools to write software. They're looking at that and saying, that's not future proof for my career. This is a dead end. I'm not going to have the skills in 5 to 10 years that I need to be competitive in the job market. So I think what ends up being at some level a human capital issue in terms of attracting and retaining great talent. And so you have to be able to get those great experiences and be able to enable your team to go faster. Otherwise, you'll end up with more systemic issues in your business. Like you can't attract new talent and develop that talent.
Yeah, now I'm reminded as I'm listening to you of a conversation that I was privy to in a boardroom not that long ago, a very large financial institution who had a problem with one of its traders who consistently, he was one of the highest performing traders, made a tremendous amount of money for the bank, but consistently avoided using some of the security protocols in making his trades. And the discussion was around, what do we now do with this guy? Because yes, on the one hand, he's generating money. On the other hand, he's generating risk. And it seemed to me that the obvious answer to that dilemma, if you like, was to actually go back to the technology and figure out why it wasn't fit for purpose. But it was interesting to me that they had immediately gone down this road of, we've got this structure, we've got this set of tools that we're protecting in a certain way. And of course, compliance gets involved. And before you know it, it's got completely out of control. But sometimes it seems to me we often forget that we should just step back a little minute and say, hang on, are the tools that we're putting in place actually fit for purpose? What's your take on that?
I think that's such a great take. And as you were saying that, the question that immediately came to my mind was, why is this person working around those tools? Yeah. Like, I would ask a different question, not what do we do with this person, but why is one of our highest performing people having to work around our technology to be successful at the business? And clearly they're being very successful. So you just start asking the five whys. Why are they working around the technology? Why do they have to do that? Why do they have to do that? And I think sometimes if you take a step back and reevaluate those things, you either get to an answer of, this is the way it's always done, or that policy has just always been in place, or you know what, maybe there is a better way to actually do that. But I think you have to be intellectually curious about the answers to really get to the root of the problem to actually transform and change your business. That's a really interesting story, though. I love that.
Let's go back to AI for a minute. I'm just wondering as well, sitting here, do you see a future where AI predicts access needs and then revokes them based on anomalies, or when the need for that access is simply gone before the human even notices?
I 1,000% believe it. Even in our technology platform, we've got capabilities like that. I think the world where AI is transforming businesses, not only in terms of our ability to generate and automate knowledge work, but it, because of the number of identities between personal assistants and enterprise agents, you just simply need to move to much more of a real-time authorization and governance control plane for those identities. It's like a silly construct to think that a enterprise agent is going to log a help desk ticket to get access to something that's going to be revoked. That's not moving at the speed of AI. That's moving at the speed of humans that are okay waiting for 2 weeks to get something that they need. So I think we necessarily have to evolve that, and it has to evolve to much more real-time governance, real-time access control, real-time escalation and de-escalation of permissions. And there's a whole set of capabilities that come with this, particularly around agents. There's an idea of intent-based access control, which is a new type of access control. It's not policy-based, not attribute-based, not role-based, but rather it's saying, what is the mission of this agent and what it needs to do? And here's the things it needs by default. And here's the things it might need sometimes. And you still might need a human in the loop to look at those things. Okay, the agent did a bunch of work and now it needs to transfer some money. We want human eyes on the risky part of the process that the agent is doing. And so there's a world where you still might need a human in the loop. But honestly, even in that world, I still think that you can kind of separate jobs to be done and think about when you have a human in the loop on something, let's say like an IT department approving access to something, just right. a very simplistic example. What is the role of that person in approving that? And what do they look at to do the approval? That is something sometimes that you can delegate to an agent. So I actually don't think that we're that far away from having agents approve agent access, but with a very clean separation of duties in terms of what they're looking at and how they're thinking about those approvals and things like that.
And with a degree, presumably, of oversight.
Yes, exactly. Think of humans in this world as like air traffic controllers. They should be able to monitor and see, and they might have their, you know, an army of their own personal agents doing work, but you still need observability and you still need escalation to humans.
I like that analogy, air traffic controllers. Yeah, I get that. Yeah, like I can see that. Alex, time is short. One final question for you, because I know you have to dash. Here at the ISF, we very often focus on the longer term. If you were to look, oh, I don't know, let's say 3 to 5 years down the line, what do you think will be the hallmark of a resilient organization in terms of how they handle their human and machine identities?
I think the world that I view in 5 years is one of what I call, and many people are calling, the agentic enterprise. And that is actually a company where you have largely transformed human employees from being just productive on the keyboard, banging away with cloud SaaS services and data, to a lot of the knowledge work maybe being done and accomplished by AI agents, but humans doing oversight, driving the inputs and the outputs of those agents, managing them in that way. And I think if you can get to that world, the scale and the productivity that we get, it's not that engineering goes away in that world. Same with marketing, same with all the other functions.
Yeah.
It's just that the expertise is what you're bringing to the table. It's not necessarily your ability to write lines of code per day. It's your ability to understand the architecture, understand the problem, work with agents to actually generate the software, and then verify that the outputs of those are good. And so I think that's the world that we're moving to, is one of much more hybrid humans and agents, where you've got humans overlooking the work of agents, dictating what goes into it, verifying the outputs, using their judgment on it. And I think we'll see a lot of productivity gains from that.
Fantastic. Alex, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to me today and sharing some of those really interesting views with our listeners. Thank you very much.
It was great. Thanks a lot, Steve. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more expert insights and thought-provoking discussions. But in the meantime, if you really enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate, review, and share the podcast. If you're interested in becoming an ISF member or continuing the conversation further, please do get in touch with me at steve.durbin@securityforum.org, or indeed get hold of me on LinkedIn. And remember, you can explore all our media and resources at our website, securityforum.org.